This is the Tax Update Podcast for September the 1st, 2008. This week, delayed rebate, tax status of accrued rebate. The Tax Update Podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners expect to do their own research and confirm my information in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting document may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file. Such prohibited use include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.linebergservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.linebergservices.com. This week, we're going to take a look at an issue that accountants often run into, which is in the regard of some of the differences between timing of recording income expenses for income tax purposes and recording them for proper accounting purposes. This particular week, we're going to look at an IRS chief counsel advice that dealt with the issue regarding the proper timing of deduction for rebate payments. The CCA analyzed the difference between the Supreme Court's rulings in the case of United States versus Hughes Property, a 1986 Supreme Court case in which the taxpayer in the case and we're going to talk about today believed was the applicable guidance, and their Supreme Court's decision in the case United States versus General Dynamics decided the following year in 1987, the case that the chief counsel argued was more applicable to this fact pattern. Now, a year of deduction generally is governed by Internal Revenue Code Section 461, and it starts out with what sounds like a provision that would bring it into line with the general rules for proper accounting treatment. And that tells us the amount of any deduction or credit allowed by this subtitle shall be the amount for the tax year which is the proper taxable year defined in a method of accounting used in computing taxable income. However, if you continue to read Section 461, you'll find it goes on for quite a few more subsections, which suggest, as you might suspect, that the answer may not be quite as simple for accountants as we suggest when we first read this document and decide that we have this nice little issue that's not really a major problem. Most important is limitation found in Section 461H, which introduces the concept of economic performance in the all-events test in making the determination. Section 461H1 begins, for purposes of this title and determining whether the amount has been incurred with respect to the item during any taxable year, the all-events test shall not be treated as met any earlier than when economic performance with respect to such item occurs. At Section 461H2, we find the rules for what is economic performance. That tells us that this is the time when economic performance occurs. And it notes that except as providing regulations issued by the Secretary, the time when economic performance occurred is going to be determined under a set of principles listed below. For services and property provided to the taxpayer, if the liability of the taxpayer arises out of providing of services to the taxpayer by another person, economic performance occurs when such person provides the services. If it's the providing of property to the taxpayer by another person, economic performance occurs as a person provides such property, or the use of the property by the taxpayer, economic performance occurs as the taxpayer uses such property. If there are services and property provided by the taxpayer, and the liability requires the taxpayer to provide property or services, economic performance occurs as the taxpayer provides such property or services. Now, the third option here deals with workers' compensation and tort liabilities of a taxpayer. And that holds that the liability of the taxpayer requiring a payment to another person that arises out of a workers' compensation act or arises out of any tort, economic performance occurs as a payment to such persons are made. And the first two options we discussed above will not apply to any liability described in that preceding sentence, which deals with workers' compensation and tort matters. Finally, in the case of any other liability, economic performance will occur at the time as determined in the regulations prescribed by the Secretary. As you may remember, going back to the start of that subsection, even if we have a case where the secretary has determined, or even if we have a case was listed in there as to how we were to determine when economic performance takes place, those conditions can still be overridden by regulations issued by the IRS. Section 461H4 provides the definition of the all events test. Remember, we have to have economic performance plus the all events test has to be satisfied. And that provides, for purposes of this subsection, the all events test is met with respect to any item if the events have occurred which determine the fact of the liability, and the amount of such liability can be determined with reasonable accuracy. Note that gave us two key issues. We have to establish both the fact that the liability exists and that we can determine the amount of that liability with reasonable accuracy. Or, looking at another way, if either of those factors are missing, the item will not be deductible for income tax purposes because the all events test will not yet have been met. Note that for financial statement reporting purposes, under Statement of Financial Accounting Standards number 5, which is what governs us in most cases, the key issue for recording a contingent liability boils down to the likelihood of the liability existing that it can be computed, a lower trigger than we find under the all events economics performance standard noted above. Of importance to the taxpayer, involved in the ruling this week, Regulation 1.461-4G3 gives us some specific guidance on when economic performance occurs for rebates a taxpayer may owe. That regulation holds that if the liability of a taxpayer is to pay a rebate, refund, or similar payment to another person, economic performance occurs as soon as the payment is made to the person to whom the liability is owed. Now, this paragraph applies to all rebates, refunds, payments, or transfers in the nature of a rebate or refund, regardless of whether they are characterized as a deduction for gross income, an adjustment to gross income or total sales, or an adjustment or addition to cost of goods sold. However, note that we have an exception under 461H3 for a recurring item election we can make that can help us solve the economic performance, but not the all events test. So even if economic performance has not occurred, as long as the all events test has taken place and we make the recurring exception election, we may find we still get to take a deduction for the item in question in the current year, not having to push it forward into a future year. That provides, in general, an item shall be treated as incurred during any taxable year if the all events test with respect to such item is met during the year, and economic performance with respect to such item occurs within the shorter of a reasonable period after the close of the tax year or 8.5 months after the close of such year. Now, you'll sometimes see this referred to as a closing within, you know, the middle of the ninth month. That's, remember, the same computation. 8.5 months is middle of the ninth month following the close of the year. Such item is recurring in nature. We also have that requirement. And the taxpayer consistently treats items as such as occurred in the taxable year in which the requirements of Clause 1 are met. And either the item is not material or the accrual of such items in the taxable year in which the requirements of the clause basically is met and we're able to meet the test results in a more proper match against income than accruing such item in the taxable year in which economic performance occurs. In making that determination, the treatment of the items on financial statements are taken into account, and it cannot apply to workers' compensation and tort liabilities. Now, that gives us a few key factors. That the 8.5 month limit serves as an absolute cap on the time period involved, but the period may still be shorter if the IRS can argue that a shorter period is a more reasonable period in this case. The item must either be immaterial or it must be an item that is required to be recognized and is recognized on the financial statements of the entity for proper matching, and most importantly, the enterprise must consistently treat this item under the recurring item exceptions. So that means the method has to be elected for the first year to which it is applied and consistently applied. Since this is an exception to the economics performance requirement, it's potentially applicable in a rebate case, which is what we're going to talk about today. Thus, if a taxpayer pays rebates and has properly elected recurring item exceptions, the question is going to boil down to whether the all events test has been met. That is the key question for the ruling we look at today. Now, this particular chief counsel advice sets out the following fact patterns for the taxpayer in the ruling. The taxpayer was a retailer of consumer products and used the accrual method of accounting. Now, it has a cash rebate program, which involves the issuance of a rebate offer in conjunction with the sale of a product, something we see quite often these days. You go into your average Best Buy, etc. You tend to find a lot of products and a rebate. You send in a coupon with the rebate and usually send it to a third-party processor. The taxpayer contracts with a third-party administrator to process the rebate. Under the program, the customer pays the full price for the product at checkout, but receives a rebate offer for a stated amount. To comply with the rebate offer, the customer has to fill out the rebate form provided with the merchandise's purchase, cut out and attach a copy of the UPC code from the merchandise, and attach a copy of the sales receipts and send those items by mail to the third-party administrator within 30 days of the date of purchase. We're all used to those types of programs that we found when we check out at a store. If the customer timely submits a properly completed form requesting a rebate and otherwise complies with the terms of the rebate offer, the third-party administrator will issue the customer a check in the amount of the rebate offer after at least 30 days have passed from the date of purchase to ensure the customer has not returned the merchandise. The check is often issued 7 months after a rebate request is properly submitted. Based upon experience, the taxpayer estimates that it pays or redeems only X percent of the total rebate offers, with X being redacted in this particular CCA. The above facts would justify and in fact require the taxpayer accrue the expected liability for financial statement purposes. But our question becomes whether the all events test has been met so that we can accrue this liability for income tax purposes. The second prong of the test, that the liability can be reasonably estimated, seems to have been met by the facts in question. The taxpayer likely has a significant base of historical data that would support their expected level of redemption of the rebate, so we'll presume that's fine and that's been shown. But given the facts, is the fact of the liability fixed given what we've been told? Now, the taxpayer believed that the Supreme Court's 7-2 ruling in favor of the taxpayer in the case of United States versus Hughes Property was sufficient to support their deduction in this particular set of facts. In Hughes, the taxpayer operated a casino and had progressive slot machines. Now, the Supreme Court noted that such machines were subject to regulation by the Nevada Gaming Commission, which required that such progressive payouts had to eventually be paid out. If you had a machine that had a progressive payout and it kept promising larger and larger payouts, that amount had to really be paid out. It's not something that the casino could offer and then take back. So if we had a progressive machine, it had to actually stay progressive and make those payouts down the line. While the casino was not required to specifically limit its use of funds for each machine, so they didn't have to take the amount for each machine of the jackpot that had been promised and set it aside, the Supreme Court noted that while the commission did not regulate those uses, it does require the casino maintain a cash reserve sufficient to provide payment of the guaranteed amount on all its progressive machines available to the public. Now, the IRS complained there couldn't be a liability fix at this point because although we might know the amount of the liability, the casino had to eventually pay out the amount of the progressive jackpot. We had no idea who was going to receive the payout. The Supreme Court disagreed that this was a fatal limitation, holding that the IRS misstated the need for identification of the winning player. That is, or it should be, a matter of no relevance for the casino operator. The obligation is there, and whether it turns out the winner is one patron or another makes no conceivable difference as to the basic liability. In our case, the taxpayer argues that while we don't know which customers are going to send in the rebate coupons and be paid the rebate, we are able to establish very well that a fixed percentage based upon very, very predictable patterns are going to send those in, and clearly we have a liability that is owed, and clearly we have an amount that would make the most sense to match up against the sale in the year in which it occurred. Thus, the taxpayer argues, the Hughes case should allow them to take a deduction currently for the rebates, even those rebates that had not yet been issued, to customers that had not yet mailed in their coupons. You know, somebody who bought something on the last day of the year at the last minute didn't have time to mail in the coupon yet, but we still should be able to accrue what we expect we're going to have to pay that customer in the rebate, our expected payout proportion of that rebate case. However, it turns out that in the following year, the Supreme Court came back to revisit the issue and distinguish the result in the second case. And that case is the one the United States believed is more applicable to the matter at hand. The case was United States versus General Dynamics Corporation. In that case, in which the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the government by a 6-3 majority, the question involved the taxpayer's deduction for unpaid claims under a self-insured medical reimbursement plan. In this case, the employees had a right to have their covered expenses paid by General Dynamics, but there would often be a delay between the time the expenses were incurred and when the employee would file a claim. The key issue here was whether General Dynamics could recognize the liability for expenses the employees had incurred at the time they were incurred, but for which a claim had not yet been filed by the year end, which it covered with a reserve for unfiled claims that it was pretty sure existed at that point. Again, had a very good background, knew exactly what should be filed, and knew based upon consultations with insurance actuaries that these were the expected amount to be paid out. The court majority, however, distinguished this case from Hughes, holding that the fact the employees had not yet filed their claim meant that, in fact, the liability was not yet fixed, since that filing was a necessary requirement for the employer to have to pay the expense. Unlike the Nevada case when we looked at the casino, which the law held had to make a payout even though we didn't notice who was somebody, in this particular case, until somebody filed a claim, we didn't have to make a payout. There was no liability yet incurred, and the court held that was a significant difference, or at least the majority of the court did. The majority held that they disagreed with the legal conclusions of the courts below, that the last event necessary to fix a taxpayer's liability was receipt of medical care by covered individuals. A person covered by a plan can only obtain payment for medical services by filling out and submitting a health expense benefits claim form. Employees were informed that submission of satisfactory proof of charges claim would be necessary to obtain payments under the plan. General Dynamics was thus liable to pay for covered medical expenses only if the properly documented claims form were filed. Some covered individuals, through oversight, procrastination, confusion over the coverage provided, or fear of disclosure to the employer of the extent or nature of the services received, might not file for reimbursement to which they were plainly entitled. Such filing is not a mere technicality. It is crucial to the establishment of liability on the part of the taxpayers. The majority specifically distinguished the case from Hughes, holding that, nor does the fail to file a claim represent the extremely rote and speculative possibility we held in Hughes, did not render an otherwise fixed liability contingent. Mere receipt of services for which in some instances claims will not be submitted does not, in our judgment, constitute the last link in the chain of events creating liability for purposes of the all events test. That is, in Hughes, the court had held, yes, there was an outside possibility, as the court notes, there always is, that a liability wouldn't be paid. Potentially might not be paid. Potentially, it's possible that, who knows why, the casino may burn down tomorrow, may not be rebuilt, and there may turn out to be nobody is going to ever have a winning jackpot out of that slot machine or out of the machines there because the company went out of business. Nevertheless, despite that remote chance that the liability would never be paid, the fact was it was a legal obligation that was fixed by the state and made it very, very remote chance there would not be an amount paid. As well, the court there noted that since it was clear and there was a direct legal obligation to pay somebody that amount, that made all the difference. In this case, unless somebody filed a claim, there existed, in the court's view, no legal obligation at this point, just a possible one. And that mere possibility wasn't enough to take the deduction. Now, that sounded good to the majority. However, in a dissenting opinion, Justice O'Connor complained about something that we as accountants probably will find very much be sympathetic toward her view. That said, the holding of the court today unnecessarily burdens taxpayers by further expanding the difference between tax and business accounting method without a compelling reason to do so. Obviously, tax accounting principles must often differ from those of business accounting. The goal of business accounting is to provide useful and pertinent information to management, shareholders, creditors, while the responsibility of the Internal Revenue Service is to protect the public fisc. Therefore, while prudent businesses will accrue expenses that are merely reasonably foreseeable, for tax purposes, liability must be fixed. But Congress has expressly permitted taxpayers to use the accrual method of counting, and from its exception in United States v. Anderson, the all-events test has been a practical adjustment of the competing interests in permitting accrual accounting and protecting the public fisc. Unfortunately, the court today ignores the pragmatic roots of the all-events test, and instead applies it in an essentially mechanistic and wholly unrealistic manner. Because the liability in this case was fixed with no less certainty than the range of expenses both routinely accrued by accrual method taxpayers and approved as deductible for tax purposes by this court and other courts in a variety of circumstances, I respectfully dissent. Now that's nice, but unfortunately, as noted, that was the minority opinion in this case. In the particular ruling in question, the chief counsel's office believed the facts that customers must submit their rebate forms make this case virtually identical to the filing of claims in General Dynamics with the same required results. The chief counsel advice notes the taxpayer's rebate liability is more like the employer's liability for medical expenses in General Dynamics than it is like the casino's jackpot liability in Hughes Properties. The casino's liability in Hughes Property was fixed by a state law requiring the taxpayer to set aside a cash reserve to cover its liability. No such facts are present in this case. Without a state law requiring the set aside of funds as in Hughes, taxpayer's liability is not fixed. There is no material distinction between this case and General Dynamics. Specifically, the advice holds the taxpayer may not treat the liability as incurred when the rebate offer is issued with the sale of the product by using the recurring item exception. The liability does not meet the requirements of the recurring item exception at that point because the liability is not fixed. Similar to General Dynamics, the filing of a claim in this case is necessary to fix taxpayer's liability. On the other hand, we see no factual basis upon which to argue that after the mailing of a properly completed rebate form, offer form by the customer, the processing and issuing of a rebate is anything other than a ministerial act. Therefore, the last event fixing the taxpayer's liability for cash rebates occurs when the customer mails a properly completed rebate form with the required attachments. So, as noted, the triggering event for recognizing the expense for tax purposes is the mailing of the form, of the rebate form by the taxpayer. Now, what this indicates is that the actual analysis of when an expense is deductible that is an accrued expense for an accrual basis taxpayer is often not terribly clear, and in fact, may it lead to results that, like the difference between Hughes and General Dynamics, appear to be at odds with each other. We need to discuss with our client the issues that are involved in accrual expenses. As well, don't blow it totally initially by simply blowing away or not remembering the need to elect the recurring item exception when we first start incurring such expenses for which economic performance will not occur under the economic performance rules, but for which the all events test will have been met and we will have payment within a time frame to allow us to make use of the recurring item exception. If you haven't paid a lot of attention there, be sure to review the rules under 461 for the recurring item exception and consider which expenses your taxpayers may be incurring that may be eligible for the recurring item exception, and be sure we get that election made properly on a return when we're first eligible to make that election. Now, this has been the tax update as normal for September the 1st of 2008, Labor Day. I'm going to be getting ready now. We're finishing up and heading toward the extended due date, the final drop dead extended due date for calendar year corporations. So I'm sure everybody's staying busy that way. Once we get past that deadline, I'm going to be going out on the road for a couple of, right around a week. I'm going to be doing a fringe benefit course for the Ohio Society of CPAs in Cleveland on the coming up on September the 19th. I then will go on to Roanoke, Virginia, and for the Virginia Society of CPAs and Virginia Tech University at the Virginia Accounting and Auditing Show, I will be presenting as breakout sessions on 2 days, a technology update at the Virginia Accounting and Auditing Show. And then I'm finally scheduled to go back to Fringe Benefits on the 24th of September in Towson, Maryland, for the Maryland Society of CPAs, where we will be talking about, again, Fringe Benefits one more time and working there. So if any of you are in any of those areas and you're considering going to one of those courses, hopefully I'll see you there. After that, the end of the month, on September 30th, I'm going to be doing a presentation on partnership taxation for the Minnesota Society of CPAs. That one will be held in Bloomington. So that's one other place I'll be showing up as I start moving into my CPE season. As always, the tax update is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limebergservices.com. Be sure to visit Limeburg Services and consider subscribing to their newsletters. This has been the Tax Update.